Let's gather them up. Senate will come to order. We do not have a quorum. Where's our leadership?
I'm here. I'll get them.
Do we have a quorum, Senator Scott? Okay, we have a quorum. Reports from standing committees.
February 22, 2018, Mr. Presidential Committee Number 4, to whom is referred Senate File 102, National Teaching Certification, respectfully brought same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Coe, Ellis, Pappas, Rothfuss, and Wasserberger. Senator Coe, Chairman.
Senator Wasserberger, do you have a motion?
Or what?
Committee of the Whole. Here we go. Mr. Vice President, do you have a motion?
Mr. President, I move that the Committee of the Whole.
The Senate resolve itself back into the Committee of the Whole. You've heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, no. That motion has carried. Mr. Minority Floor Leader. Senator Wasserberger.
Do we have a change sheet?
Okay. The next. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 118. Would the reading clerk? What am I doing?
Point of order?
Senator Rothfuss.
I believe 118 may still be in appropriation. Do we have that back from appropriation? We do not. Okay.
The next bill for our consideration is... Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 119. No. Would the reading clerk please read the bill? Senate File 119. We'll wait a while.
We need appropriations to cover it.
You've got the check and it's here.
Yeah. It's, we need an appropriation member to cover it, so we don't want to do that one right now. We're just laying it back for a while.
Perfect.
73. And I'll take 73. Okay.
You're doing 73?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your help.
Well, that was really
good. Next bill for your consideration is Senate File 73. The reading clerk will read the Senate file.
Senate File 73, Permits for Small Underground Water Wells, an act relating to water, sponsored by Senator Meyer, was referred to Committee Number 5, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Barnard, Emmerich, Hicks, Meyer, and Moniz. Senator Hicks, Chairman.
You have heard the motion. What is your pleasure, Senator Hicks? One moment, Senator Hicks. My apologies. Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when a committee of the whole rise and report that it does so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 73, and for an explanation of the bill, I would ask that you call on Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Senator Hicks. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, there was a standing committee amendment. I'd ask that the reading clerk read it in at this time.
Senate File 73, Standing Committee Amendment to Number 1, page 1, line 9.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Standing Committee Amendment, and I will explain the amendment as I explain the bill. If we look at page 1, down at the bottom, you can see that the 413390 is on applications. The amendment in that area carries over into page 3. Lines 3 through 5, and this is where we go in and we look at the wells that are 25 gallons per minute or less. And what we say is that the wells that are more than that, they basically have to have a detailed description of the proposed use when they do the application. Now, that in no way precludes the person who has a 25-gallon minute well, when they do their proof of beneficial use, to going in and saying, you know, what the horsepower of the well is, how many gallons it pumps, and what the use is. Then we go in, Mr. Chairman, what we were seeking on doing was to grandfather these de minimis use wells and to make a multi-purpose permit. And the purposes on that permit would include domestic, it would include miscellaneous, it would include shelter belts, and it would include livestock. And those are the normal things that are used on wells, whether they're on 40-acre ranchettes or on your farms and ranches. Oftentimes, a well is permitted as domestic use, and as the need arises, the permitter of the well will go out and run a line to a barn or a shop or a garage, or run a line out to the 4-H small barn or to the on a ranchette, maybe down to where they house a couple of horses for the family to enjoy. And so the uses change over the course of the well. Very seldom is there a change in the actual permit or an addition to the permit. So, Mr. Chairman, what we're doing is actually, I guess, looking at reality and not trying to fight reality, because when you fight reality, often you lose. So, Mr. Chairman, what we're trying to do is go back in and do the grandfather. And so the second part in the amendment, where we go back in and grandfather, that goes up in the application part on page 3, line 3. We modify that and put in the different uses that we talked about, including the shelter belts. And then over on page 4 in the other line, we make it read a little bit better down there in lines 15, 16, and 17. In that, because we had it to where it was going to allow the state engineer to require that the owner of the well put on a meter. In this area here, what we allow for is that for the state engineer to measure the well to make sure that it is less than 25 gallons a minute. And there's a lot of ways that that can happen. They can take a look at the electrical outlets there, the fuses and the controls and the heaters, and make a determination as far as the load. They can do it that way, or they can clamp on a electronic measuring device that will measure the water. And if somebody's out of compliance and it's over 25 gallons, then, Mr. Chairman, they lose all the benefits of this bill and the statute, and they're right back as to if they were a large volume well. Then the other part that we go in, that we go into 41.3935, and that's adjudication procedure, Mr. Chairman. And what we say there, that is, if a well produces 25 gallons per minute or less and is adjudicated for domestic stock or miscellaneous use or use for shelter belts, use of the well for any of those purposes shall not require an additional adjudication under this section, regardless of when the well was adjudicated. So that's the grandfather phase, and it also provides for that in the future that you can add these different uses to it. Now, the definition of de minimis use is, I guess, enforced by some interstate compacts that we have with Nebraska, in that Nebraska v. Wyoming, all wells 25 gallons a minute or less were basically written out of that particular agreement because they were of de minimis use. So that's why we're going with the 25 gallons a minute. We have 25 gallons a minute in our statutes for this classification of wells already. Now, we do have a provision in here that says that for any compacts where that isn't the case, and there is one that's right now, and that's the Yellowstone Compact, and it's already contradiction with current statutes, not particular this one, but our current statute on domestic use says that we can have 1 acre that we can go ahead and plant our garden, our lawn, our trees, our shrubs, and that's what we had the benefit of. But if you're on the Yellowstone River in that compact area, it's actually one half of an acre. And so we wanted to make sure that we weren't contrary with this particular modifications to the statute, so we defer to any existing compact languages. So, Mr. Chairman, I think that explains the bill. The need for it is that, simply, Mr. Chairman, there are tens of thousands of these small wells around there with people essentially out of compliance. If, indeed, the state engineer ever sought to begin to regulate these, it would be a huge burden as far as the number of people that would have to be employed to actually go back in and go through the process of putting these permits in. I think it's something that's really a benefit to most people that want to develop the water of Wyoming for their own personal use, and it is for de minimis use. It's for their own personal use. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would stand for questions, and if there are no, I would ask that we have a affirmative vote on this bill.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. We are on the amendment at this time. Any discussion on the amendment? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, on the bill.
Any discussion on the amendment? Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Meyer's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 73, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 73 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I will say to the Senate that I've got one of these wells that is exactly as the good senator describes. Started out as a house well. Well, we put a stock tank on it. We extended it to the heifer barn so we would water the heifers inside the barn when we had them in the calve. We put another stock tank on it. We ran a sideline out to the shop so we could have water for purposes out there. I don't think I've got a conflict of interest in this bill. I think I have many constituents that are in exactly the same circumstance and probably tens of thousands of other people in Wyoming. This bill just codifies common sense, Mr. Chairman. I intend to vote for it.
Thank you, Senator Scott, representing heifers as well. Any further discussion on Senate File 73? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Hicks' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 73, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 73, Permits for Small Underground Water Wells, has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 74. Will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 74. Crimes Against Critical Infrastructure, an act relating to crimes and offenses, sponsored by Senator Christensen, was referred to Committee Number 1, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Anselmi Dalton, Christensen, Hicks, Kinski, and Nethercott. Senator Christensen, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 74. There is an amendment. If we could have that read in, please.
Senate File 74, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 4.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move Senate File 74, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. And with that, we'll get to the amendment in a minute. Ladies and gentlemen of the Senate, this is a bill that is designed to preempt intentional trespass and damage to critical infrastructure. Critical infrastructure is defined in this bill, and when you look at that definition, you start to realize how that crosses our county lines, our city lines, and goes all across the state. I'll just tell you, to really get your hands around this, when we talk about critical infrastructure, we have petroleum refineries, we have electrical power generating systems, substations, switching stations, the big power lines. We have chemical, polymer, and rubber manufacturing facilities. We've got water intake structures, and that would be in all communities and all municipalities. We've got water treatment facilities throughout all of our municipalities. We've got natural gas compressor stations, liquid natural gas terminals, telecommunication switching centers, wireless communication, railroad switching yards, tracks, and
terminals, gas processing plants, transmission facilities for federally licensed radios and television systems. Steel making, that one gets down to the shops. Chemical dams, water systems, with from big reservoirs to small ones owned by municipalities. Natural gas distribution, crude oil refineries, above and underground mining facilities, data centers. As we go through these things and you think about them, they're in every county. One or more, usually more of these, are in every county and across Wyoming and in every town. And so when we think about what this bill is doing, this bill is to stop those intentional acts to disrupt these critical infrastructure systems. And it may be as small as a community, it may be as small as a town, or it may be as large as a distribution point that affects the entire western states of the U.S. And so that's why we really need this bill. And there's been some comments that said, well, those are already existing crimes. But when you start to think about the level, our statutes primarily address a person-on-person, a more intimate act, if I could describe it that way. What we're talking about here is the potential to disrupt communities, states, and with a ripple effect that could roll across the country. You take out the gas supply that reaches across, the natural gas supply that reaches across the western states. The other thing that we don't always think about with the reason this is so important is it's not just a disruption of the company and the customer, but if you think about what drives our economy, it's this mineral supply and our cut of the pie, our share of the pie. And you disrupt that, and where does the funding go that we're so generously allocating in this very session? So there's all kinds of different aspects and reasons that we need to take this serious. This bill goes in, and on page 2, we talk about intentionally. That's new. Let's work the amendment in, if I could, because this addresses some of the concerns that some of you have heard about with the bill. And over on page 2, up on line 4, up on line 2, it says, a person is guilty of impeding critical infrastructure if he, and then on line 4, impedes or inhibits the operation. And our First Amendment strikes inhibits and adds intentionally, raises a standard at the beginning of line 4. Intentionally impedes the operations of critical infrastructure or damages, destroys, vandalizes, and we're going to eliminate the word vandalizes, defaces or tampers with the equipment at a critical infrastructure facility. And then it goes down to the penalty. Impeding is a felony punishable by imprisonment of not more than 10 years and a fine of not more than $100,000. So what we've done in the very first half of page 2, we've raised the standard. It's got to be intentional, and that's a much more difficult standard to prove. We've gotten rid of inhibits, we've gotten rid of a vandalize, and part of the concern is that's the very definition in the vandalism. People were concerned it could throw a loop out there that would pick up kids without real serious intent. And so we just cleaned that up. Let me go down to on paragraph B, line 11 on page 2, and this conversation then continues throughout the bill. But we talk about these larger fines, these larger penalties, and the reason for that is it goes back to the scope of the crime, the scope of the act that is being attempted or completed and the effect of it. It's not a personal one-on-one thing. It's something to actually disrupt society. Further on to the amendment, down on line 17, we strike hires and puts in compensates, which goes to the idea that there are now, we're seeing across the nation, a more calculated act where people are actually being encouraged, compensated, hired, command, procures, encouraged, where you have sponsoring organization of this kind of eco-terrorism. And people who may not realize what they're doing, but somebody is pulling the strings. And so the other critical part of this bill is it reaches out and makes those folks, puts them in the accountability chain. And that's where you see these numbers that are very large compared to what the rest of Wyoming statute shows when we see a fine not to exceed $1 million. The intent of this bill, let me go back to that again, is to discourage and say Wyoming is not the place you want to do. If you're bent on this kind of devious behavior, You might want to look somewhere else, but if you come here, we take it very serious. Going on with the amendment, over on the top of page 3, there's a new definition on line 3. And that new definition is what also clears up some of the concerns. We add the word impedes. And on your amendment page, that is on line 10. Impedes means to block or prevent legal access to or operation of a critical infrastructure facility in a manner not authorized by law. We've heard a lot of concern that this is going to chill freedom of speech. Well, freedom of speech is a right, and it's legal, but freedom of speech does not extend to me being able to go on and tear up your property, your equipment, your place, your facilities. And when it gets to this critical infrastructure, it's all the more serious. So we've got a clear definition of what impedes means so that people understand this is not a big catch-all statute that's trying to take away anybody's right to gather and discuss or just disagree with an act, as long as they're doing it legally. And then on down on the amendment, on page 4, line 13, that's conforming language. On line 16, this is getting rid of inhibit and vandalize. And then on page 4, line 21, we delete hires and put in compensates. Again, conforming. Then down on line 24, the amendment impedes. It just is conforming language on the definition. Then we go down over to page 6 where we see our next little change. On page 6, line 1, you see a definition, or it has to do with rail yards, and that's just consistent with already existing definitions and what it means. It says a facility that is fenced, and then pursuant to Wyoming Statute 379304. More cleanup language is consistent. Now, we do add some new language in this amendment over on page 8. On line, we're going to delete 13 and 14. And put a new definition in there, a new language. So we're deleting a dam that is regulated by the state of Wyoming or the federal government, and the new language is any dam that supplies irrigation, industrial, or municipal water supplies. And the reason for that is that that covers the Buffalo Bill Dam, that covers a dam or several reservoirs that the city of Cheyenne has, all critical infrastructure. Down at the bottom of page 8, on line 19, we strike the word regular and replace it with regulator, so it reads a regulator station. And then over back on 9, two more pieces of new language in here. On line 10 of page 9, we add in a definition for cable television infrastructure, including head poles or head ends, poles, cable television lines, coaxial, and other equipment attached. The reason for this is today, cable lines do a whole lot more than bring you cable television. For emergency communications and notifications, and there's data moving back and forth, so it's much more than what you would first look at of thinking, why does cable television need to be protected? It's really the infrastructure. And then one more new definition in here on just below that, and that defines on the amendment on page 2, line 12, a large water diversion structure or large water transmission infrastructure. And the example is if you've been up in the northeast or northwest part of the state at the Great Northwestern Senators Community, you might have noticed that at one point they have a heck of a water pipe system that crosses one of their canyons and delivers water all over the northwest corner of the state. And so we're trying to address those things that could take care of that. That's the amendment, and I'd call for the vote on the amendment. Your favorable vote.
Thank you, Senator Christensen. We are on the amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 74, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 74 has passed the Committee of the Whole. We are back on Senate File 74. Any discussion? Or Senator Christensen, do you have anything further?
Chairman, a little bit more. On page 3, we go into of the now amended bill, critical infrastructure trespass. One of the questions is we already have trespass. But this is, again, at another level, and it all ties together with these different new pieces of felony language. So it's part of the language, the thread of statute that they rely on. But it's important to see in here that there are definitions that are, you know, the first example, we do have misdemeanor trespass specific to critical infrastructure. And then over on page 4, we have felony trespass. And the reason for that becomes evident when it says critical infrastructure trespass is a felony not more than 10 years, a fine not less than $10,000, not more than $100,000, or both, if the trespass is committed. Now I'm on line 10 of page 4. If the trespass is committed with the intent to impede the operations, damage, destroy, deface, or tamper with the equipment of critical infrastructure. And so that's the act where they're going after these large critical infrastructures that impact many, many people. And then down in paragraph D, line 20, page 4, we go back into the organization that participates in this and is supporting. And if there is a supporting organization, that's when we get back into those big consequences to say Wyoming's not the place. Ladies and gentlemen, I think that basically covers the bill. As far as spelled out infrastructure items over on page 6, 7, 8, 9 and 10, including the new language, on 10 through page 9. Then the new language, you see what the definition are. They're spelled out. And as I started this conversation with, when you look at that list of critical infrastructure items designated by this bill, they're throughout the state. Parts or many of them are in every county, and parts of them, some of them are in every municipality. Very serious bill. The intent is never about chilling freedom of speech. It's about taking on those characters, those devious folks, who would try to disrupt society, change what's going on, and at the extreme level could affect the western half of the nation with ripple effects across this country. With that, I'd ask for your favorable vote.
Thank you, Senator Christensen. We are on Senate File 74, Crimes Against Critical Infrastructure. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, you know, I'm very much in sympathy with the basic purposes of this bill, and it's an unfortunate commentary on where the society is that we may need to do something like this, but that's the fact of life sometimes these days. But I always get concerned when we get one of these criminal bills that we're going to have some unintended consequences. And, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at page 4, lines 13 and 14 in the definition of the 10-year felony. And single I says impede or inhibit the operation of a critical infrastructure facility. And I relate it to a particular concern that I got involved in because a bunch of my constituents were involved in. And the problem they had, Mr. Chairman, had to do with a petroleum pipeline, which, as I understand, and maybe I've missed it, but I think is part of this critical infrastructure we're talking about here. And it came through an urban area, and it was an older pipeline, been there some time. And what happened was the bureaucracy that managed the pipeline, which was private sector, I forget what state they were from, Oklahoma or Texas, one of those, came through and wanted to tear up everybody's yard, tear up people's trees, and just, they said they couldn't see it well enough to fly it, to look for leaks. Well, if they'd ever had even the suggestion of a leak, the local residents would have called 911 about it long before the pipeline company ever found it flying it. It was just ridiculous, but it was a vicious, and I mean vicious, Mr. Chairman, bureaucracy that was managing these, and I'm afraid with that language, they would take the citizens that were protesting there behavior and trying to get them to modify and use a little common sense and threaten them with a 10-year felony. And I'm concerned about what this bill could lead to as an unintended consequence. And I'm particularly concerned about that impedes or inhibit the operations, because they were certainly seeking to inhibit what the operators wanted to do, which was tear up their yards and tear out the shade trees. And it really was, Mr. Chairman, one of the most vicious bureaucratic activities that I ever saw. And it had been at least a respected private company that was doing it. And maybe I get way too upset, Mr. Chairman, when I see the way bureaucracies, both public and private, can push citizens around. But I'm afraid that this bill might be used to threaten them. And so that's my concern, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Further discussion, Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, and this was something that we heard in committee, but I would point out to my colleague that his concerns are unfounded if you read the language at the bottom of page 5, starting with A. When we define the definition of critical infrastructure as it relates to pipelines, it's any above-ground portion of an oil, gas, hazardous liquid, or chemical pipeline. And then it further modifies that on the next page. Even that above-ground facility would have to be fully enclosed by a fence and clearly designated. So I think that takes care of my colleague's concern that the scenario that he portrayed wouldn't be captured under this particular piece of legislation.
Thank you, Senator Hicks. Further discussion, I'm going to go to Senator Meyer. One moment, Senator Meyer. Senator Meyer.
I was searching for the definition of critical infrastructure. One is that critical infrastructure be considered like the control lines for our intercontinental ballistic missiles. That's fairly critical. I didn't know whether that was under here or not. You know, I'm just wondering. And then I was looking at line 16, subsection C in the original bill. I'm wondering if that's changed or not. I'm on page 2, line 16, Romanet C. Is that the same? Has that been changed by the amendment?
Thank you, Senator Meyer. We'll get that.
Now, the way this one reads, this could be a lobbyist, because there really could be, because they could be organized and they could be impeding critical infrastructure, but I guess the infrastructure has to be built. It isn't something we're planning on building. Is that correct?
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Senator Boner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can at least answer the first question with the underground cables that control our nuclear missiles. I have confidence that the federal government can protect those assets just fine, whether we pass this law or not. And any intrusion will be dealt with swiftly with those assets.
Thank you, Senator Boner. I suspect that's accurate. Senator Meyer.
A little personal story here. I guess if the good senator from Natrona County can get by with it, I'll try.
Will this be about heifers?
No. We had some critical infrastructure of our own, which was a water pipeline going across the area where there was the critical infrastructure of the Air Force, and the Air Force staked it out and says, okay, you can dig from here on. And we dug from there on three turns of the trencher, and whoo, right through the critical infrastructure. It was a circus, Mr. Chairman. It was.
Thank you, Senator Martin. Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I confess that I have trespassed on critical infrastructure. It was definitely fenced, but the fence wasn't very strong. It had a few gaps in it. And it was a fact, it was in your town. And I used that critical infrastructure. I used to ride the train from Flint Street and 16th down to the Buckhorn Bar, and we'd get up. A particular well-known bar, and we'd get off that
Thank
critical
you, Senator
infrastructure.
Case. Yes.
And I noticed that many of that critical infrastructure had been damaged. It had markings on it. Almost every piece of critical infrastructure that comes through there, if you notice, it has, it looks like very organized activity to do that. That would be in the $1 million range, I think, if there's aiding and abetting by organizations probably in L.A. or somewhere like that, Mr. President. But, you know,
We have done a lot in this country. We have built nuclear power plants, the Alaskan pipeline. We have built a railroad across the nation. We have put in the telecommunications infrastructure. We have built the greatest country in the world. And we have done it. And people have protested. And people have, in our history, in our long history of statehood, we have done this again and again and again. And we've never saw fit to have to do this. Because our existing laws work. And I know that a lot of people were very upset this year and felt violated by a protest that was occurring in one of our neighboring states about an oil pipeline. And that drove that was a painful experience, I think, for people on all sides. I think it was very painful to watch. It was painful, obviously, for the authorities trying to deal with that situation, Mr. President, Mr. Chairman. But it seems obvious to me that when you try to deconstruct what happened there, things did get out of control. And it was it's very unfortunate. But I don't think the laws were even applied as they could have been. The existing laws weren't applied to charge those protesters as they could have been. Why was that? Well, it was a delicate political situation, Mr. Chairman, and people had to use judgment, and whether you thought the judgment was right or wrong, finally, in the end, cold weather prevailed more than anything, I think, and people went home. And the pipeline was finished, and we moved on. But this bill wouldn't have changed that. Those people were highly motivated. And if that state had this bill in place, I don't think it would have changed a thing. It wouldn't have changed the ability of the authorities to exercise power or round people up or arrest them or throw them in prison. It wouldn't have changed a thing because it was politics that was driving that. A huge nation was trying to come to grips with fossil fuel and things. And we've been on the cusp of this before. We were on the cusp of this in the 1960s. We've been on the cusp of it when we tried to construct nuclear power plants. We went through World War II and built oil pipelines and had saboteurs, and we made it. We're a robust nation. We move along. This bill would not have changed Standing Rock a bit. You might say this is not about Standing Rock, but it wouldn't have changed it. I think we're overreacting here. Truly overreacting. Plenty of good laws in Wyoming. We need to apply them fairly. And when you begin to start building laws about intent or enhanced penalties because of what it is, if it's a valve on an oil pipeline that is vandalized or destroyed versus a valve on a domestic water service for a house, same value, you're trying to say that it's a different situation. Well, I sort of get that, but honestly, it won't do any good to do this. And it will, what it really does is undermine people's faith in government. And it undermines our faith in each other. And it undermines our ability to be tolerant with each other and to understand where other people are coming from, Mr. Chairman. I'd ask that we oppose this bill.
Thank you, Senator Case. Senator Christensen?
Mr. Chairman, as to the confession we may or may not have heard a little while ago, you know, while trespassing is a crime, the fact that there was no criminal intent to tear that rail line down, shut it or anything, I think clearly says that's not what we're talking about. As for people painting on cars, rail cars, we removed vandalized just for that reason. You know, people have a right to protect their property, and you don't have a right under freedom of speech to go tear up somebody else's place, let alone try to change and impact a culture, a society, and hundreds to millions of people to make a political statement. If you want to make a political statement, go into politics and then see if you can put the votes together. You know, the key to this bill is those standards of intentional behavior. Those are tough standards to make. When we hear the thing about, well, this has never happened, there's a man doing 30 years in the federal pen right now that was conspiring with Al-Qaeda to take out one of Wyoming's gas hubs. There's a gas site down in California just in the last couple of years that there was a very organized, deliberate attack on it with high-powered rifles, and they still haven't been able to solve it. But these are not unknown. There have been other plans out there that's happening. And the idea on this one is to discourage and say Wyoming is not an easy target. If you're going to come here, beware. And I'd say that part of that battle has already been recognized with the amount of pressure we're receiving from around the nation who say, no, it is our right to go in. We've had examples like the former, nationally inspired leader Martin Luther King. But as I understand it, his intention was never to commit criminal behavior to tear down critical infrastructure. This isn't about being able to protest. That's about freedom of speech. This is about committing crimes. This, nowhere in here does it say you can't gather, you can't express your opinion, but you know, it doesn't give you the right to start tearing things up and to commit crimes. So there's a big difference, and let's just make sure we know that. We are vulnerable. And if you don't believe that, this is supported by our state law enforcement public safety officers across the state of Wyoming. Overwhelming support from your county commissioners association, supported by your Wyoming municipalities. Homeland Security in Wyoming says this is a top priority. Over and over. I know there are opponents to this that are worried. We had an example saying, well, if my group took water bottles to North Dakota, does that make us liable for $1 million? No, that does not. But I'll tell you, if the group gets organized and starts sending out activists with criminal intentions that meets these standards and it can be proved, those are the folks we want them to look somewhere else, and hopefully we can discourage them completely and they realize how serious this is. There was just an article came out in the New York Magazine to talk about that incident up to our northeast and how those people very deliberately had long plans and carried out their acts. And they came from out of state to do that. We don't want Wyoming to be open to that kind of business. And so this is a strong statement, I agree, but we are more vulnerable, I believe, than any other state in the nation. When you travel across this state, like most of us do, and you really start looking, you get a sense of how open Wyoming is, and we like it and we love it that way. But if people have this kind of act in mind, we're going to have something waiting for them to say, this is not the place to do that. Go someplace else if you're truly insistent. I'd urge your support of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Christensen. We're on Senate File 74, Crimes Against Critical Infrastructure. Any further discussion? Question has been called. All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 74, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 74 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 83. Will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 83, Controlled Substance Prescription Tracking, an act relating to controlled substances, sponsored by Senator Baldwin, was referred to Committee Number 10, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Baldwin, Boehnert, Bouchard, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the Senate file. What is your pleasure? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so with a recommendation that Senate File 83 do pass. There was no standing committee amendment, and I yield to Senator Baldwin for an explanation of this good little Senate file.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator Baldwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bring to you Senate File 83. This is what I like to call a feel-good bill, but not feel-too-good bill. That was a joke.
That was pretty good.
Yeah, it's as good as I get at this time of day. Yesterday, late in the day, we talked about the opioid addiction task force a little bit. In that discussion that we talked about yesterday, we had a little conference with several of the people that are involved in this issue, and this is another one of those things that we discussed. In that step towards curing some of our problem with opioid addiction and opioid deaths, opioid overdose deaths, this is a small step down that road that we've already started before the task force gets going. Without going through the bill too in depth, I'll just tell you it does three things, essentially. Number one, there's something called the PDMP, the prescription drug monitoring program, which is simply a database for prescriptions for narcotics or for controlled substances. At this point in time, some practitioners or some healthcare practitioners are registered for that, some aren't. It's not a requirement that they be registered for that. One of the things that this bill does is it takes and makes it mandatory for every healthcare practitioner to be registered on that system. Doesn't make it mandatory at this time for everybody to consult that before they do the prescriptions, which some states around us do. But what it does right now is make it mandatory to be registered, so it is available to you to use. That's number one thing it does. The number two thing it does is the prescription drug monitoring program right now requires class 1, 2, 3, and 4 drugs to be on that system. This extends that to class 5. And the biggest one that people think about when you talk about class 5 is the codeine cough syrups, which are currently not registered in the PDMP. We included those in because we think that's an important product of abuse. And that is confirmed by the Board of Pharmacy and by all DEA and all the folks that have looked into us. That's number two. It includes one more class of drugs in. The third thing it does is it closes a loophole right now. And I use the example of somebody that goes into an ER in northeast Wyoming and goes and gets a – they go in on a weekend and all the pharmacies are closed. The practitioner in that emergency room gives them 10 pain pills. We'll just say they're Percocet for now. Right now, those 10 Percocet don't need to be registered into the PDMP because they're not coming from a dispensing pharmacy. That person then drives to southeast Wyoming, goes to another ER, same day, different doctor, different provider, and gets 10 more Percocet for exactly the same situation. And then that person travels to a community in the center of the state, same day, gets 10 more Percocet. By the time that person is done, if they just stay within the state of Wyoming, they can virtually visit 5 or 6 different practitioners or emergency rooms and end up with a fairly large quantity of opioids, or Percocet in this case. We closed that loophole. Right now, those are not reported on the PDMP. We closed that loophole. We want all dispensing of all those narcotics and all those controlled substances brought in and reported on the PDMP. So that when the practitioner goes in and looks on the PDMP, not only the ones that came through a pharmacy are there, the ones that came through an emergency room or a community clinic are also there. So that's the three things that it does. There were no amendments. It's a starting point, and we're starting down that road towards closing down the opioid problem. And I would be happy to report, I just read a report this morning, that maybe there already is a little bit of a reversal trend. Opioid deaths are decreasing in at least 5 different states. So just bringing attention to the problem is starting to bring some change. And we want to make more change because I would rather there were no deaths. But with that, I would leave you this great bill and ask for your aye vote.
Thank you, Senator Baldwin. Discussion on Senate File 83, Controlled Substance Prescription Tracking. Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize I didn't stand up in between bills, but may I have privilege of the floor?
You may have privilege of the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today we have Amber Tealander and a group of students from LCCC who are dental hygiene students, and they are here to watch the legislative process. So welcome. Please stand up, and we'll cheer for you.
Thank you, Senator Ellis, and welcome students out in the gallery. Welcome everybody out in the gallery, in fact. Yeah, Senator Pappas says he needs his teeth cleaned. Is there any further discussion on Senate File 83? Question has been called. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 83, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 83 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration has just shown up. It's Senate File 118. Oh, excuse me, that's wrong. That's a post-it note. It is. Senate File 97. Will the reading clerk please read the Senate file? There's a difference between a bill and a post-it note.
Senate File 97, Medicaid and SNAP Eligibility Requirements 2, an act relating to welfare, sponsored by Senator Hicks, was referred to Committee Number 10, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Baldwin, Boner, Bouchard, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise report it do so with a recommendation that Senate File 97 do pass, and I yield to Senator Hicks for an explanation of the Senate file.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman and members, ladies and gentlemen, this is the welfare reform bill. In January, CMS adopted new regulations that allows states to submit for a waiver for work for those receiving for those able-bodied recipients receiving Medicaid. Just want to walk you through the bill. So if you go through to page 2, it directs, it says that the Department of Health shall apply for a waiver, and then upon approval, the department shall implement this section. What will happen then is beginning 3 months after the department determines a person is eligible for the work requirement, they'll have to participate in either work or attend a school for 20 hours per week, participate in an employment, training, or work program for 20 or more hours a week. If you flip over to page 3, would require to volunteer or establish in an established community service organizations for 20 more hours, or comply with any of the combination above. Could be work, could be community service, could be a training program. So it is a cumulative total of any or all of those activities for 20 hours a week. We get into the middle. We start subsection C is the exemptions, the people that would be exempted out of this program. If you're 18 years or younger, 65 years or older, certified by a health care provider that you're medically unable to meet the requirements of subsection B, which is the work requirements. If you're pregnant, you're exempt. If you're the parent or legal guardian or other primary caregiver of a dependent that is 6 years or younger, has a serious medical condition, a regular participant in the drug addiction and rehab program, receiving unemployment compensation, and also if you're exempt from the requirements under both the TAMF and the SNAP programs, you're also exempt from the work requirement. And you can also be exempted by the department for good cause. If you flip over to page 5, these work requirements would also run concurrently with any work requirements that are already being imposed for those receiving assistance under the TAMF or the SNAP program. Subsection E, this is the verification component of the bill. It says the department shall verify compliance every 6 months for those eligible for the work requirements, and then it would actually implement 9 months after we adopt this. Subsection F.
Senator Hicks?
Yep.
Will you please pause for a moment? We do not have a quorum at this time. Now the quorum just walked in. Please continue, Senator Hicks.
Thank you, Senator Quorum, for returning to the floor. So down to subsection F, it says the department shall determine medical assistance recipients has failed. So this is somebody, once the department determines they are not meeting the 20-hour work requirements, will extinguish for 12 months those Medicaid benefits. Down at the bottom of the page, as far as verification of work requirements, Workforce Service will provide that information to the Department of Health. And it says any appeals or protests associated with this follow the governing administrative hearings from the Department of Health. And then it has rulemaking authority. One of the things that I think that's important about this program is subsection 3. Subsection 3 says any federal savings made available from the implementation of this waiver shall be used to support child care programs for medical assistance recipients who are actually trying to comply with the terms and conditions of the work program here. So there is a support system with any savings for those families that are working on that. Mr. Chairman, I would just tell everybody, I pulled up the U.S. labor statistics. There's 154 million people got up this morning and went to work. There's always some discussion on these type of programs as to what's the intent? I think the intent when we try to do this is try to give people the opportunity to find a job, develop job skills through training. We want to provide an opportunity to network, to build those relationships with people that are in those unemployment fields, develop an education and job skills. It's really designed to provide people an opportunity to move up in our society and get off of the welfare rolls and become self-sufficient. That's really the intent of the program, Mr. Chairman. I'd stand for any questions.
Thank you, Senator Hicks. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one quick question. I noticed there's not a fiscal note to this. Can someone explain to me what impact it will have on the Department of Health, because there is, seems to me, quite a bit of verification, and I don't know what the magnitude of that impact is. So please, a little explanation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Pappas, thank you. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, we had extensive testimony in committee from the Department of Health. On the specific point, the director came and talked to us that it would require a massive IT system to do any verification other than what he called a self-attestation, where you take the individual's word. He said there would be, I think it was 3,500, if I'm remembering correctly. 3,300, approximately. It was Medicaid recipients that would fall under this and would be subject to this requirement. We suggested to him that there was something between the massive IT system and no verification at all, that you want to find out somebody working, you put an employee on the phone to call a sample of the employers and see if you can get verification. There's a few very simple things you can do. You don't have to do it with everybody. If you're doing it with some, you'll get pretty good compliance. You know, same philosophy that the Internal Revenue Service uses on us. My sense is the Department of Health didn't want to hear that answer and was looking for reasons not to implement this. There was considerable discussion, Mr. Chairman, going beyond the question, from the Department of Health and the difficulty of getting CMS waivers, Mr. Chairman, and they have a real point there. We've had a waiver into CMS for 2 years to accommodate the tribes, and we can't get them to act. Our congressional delegation can't get them to act. That bureaucracy can be a black hole back there. And the department director did have a point there, and there are some difficulties in getting it, and it would cost something to get it. But I think we have a real problem. Let me say, I've signed on this bill. I'm supportive of the bill. I want to vote for it, and I want to see it implemented, because this is one of the remedies that we used in our welfare reform back in 1996. I think it might have been 1995, whenever we did the welfare reform. And it helped. And our Family Services Department has done just a marvelous job implementing that requirement there. We have gotten most of the people who are on the welfare program, most people that come onto it, promptly get out into the workplace. I think the same could happen here if the department wanted to implement it. But there is going to be a problem with CMS. We do sometimes hear they'll have trouble finding jobs. We've done any number of programs, starting out with the welfare reform, with our community corrections, and et cetera, that have required people to find jobs, and they're available, even when our economy isn't that good. We've never had real obstacles with people just couldn't find a job, such as you might get in a place, say, like Appalachia, where there just aren't enough jobs and a legacy population that hangs on there. We don't have that problem. The question is what to do about it. I'm a little afraid if we turn the current Department of Health loose to seek a waiver, they'll structure it so we'll never get it and find all kinds of ways not to get it done. I think maybe the solution, and I haven't had a chance to talk to the sponsor about this, but I've been thinking about it since we heard the bill, would be a somewhat delayed effective date. So when the administration turns over, this is something that the incoming people will see with fresh eyes and see if they can figure out a way to make it work, because it has proved to be very valuable. But we did have a lot of testimony as to how much it would cost and how difficult it would be to implement. And I, for one, don't think that most of that was truthful if somebody really wanted to implement it.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, just to ask for clarity, that means the department will come up with its own verification process. There's nothing dictating what type of process they're going to use for verification. Correct?
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Senator Scott, clarification?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, on that point, they may well have to trouble with 1115 waivers. You got to negotiate them with the federal government. And one of the things that could happen if both bureaucracies don't think anything that restricts Medicaid enrollment is a good idea, and I suspect that may be the case, they may well agree and each one blame the other on a verification process that's impossibly expensive, so we don't implement it. That's a real risk in something like this. Mr. Chairman, you know, a long time ago, I used to work for the federal government on the Washington side of this sort of thing, and we kept hearing from the bureaucracy, you can't do that that you want to do because the states won't stand for it. I get here, and I hear, you can't do that because the federal government won't stand for it. And what goes on is the two bureaucratic empires get together and defend each other. And I'm afraid of that with a health department that doesn't want to do it. And I think that's a very real risk at this point. So I am a little nervous of the immediate effective date in this bill.
Thank you, Senator Scott. We are on Senate Bill 97, Medicaid and SNAP Eligibility Requirements 2. Further discussion? Senator Hicks.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and just to add a little more clarity to my colleagues' questions on this, so as part of the IT system, you can recover up to 50, in some cases 90% of the state's costs are eligible for recovery through CMS to implement the IT portion of this program. My good colleague to the left talked about the time that it takes to get some of these waivers. I would just let you know that there's a new sheriff in town back there. This waiver wasn't available until January when CMS let this out. They've already issued one waiver to the state of Kentucky, and there's actually seven or eight states right now with pending waivers. So they're moving a little faster back there now than they were on the previous administration for these work-related waivers. But again, there is also financial assistance to set up the IT program. As far as the cost in the bill, Workforce Services would help do the compliance on the work requirements. It's not another administrative duty to be put on the Department of Health. So I do share my colleague's concern, and he certainly has a lot more experience in dealing with the current administration and the Department of Health here than I do here, so I would defer to him on any potential amendments on this. With that, I'd ask for your favorable consideration of a yes vote.
Thank you, Senator Hicks. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 97, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 97 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is Senate File 101. Will the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 101, Private Property Rights, National Historic Preservation Act, an act relating to the administration of government, sponsored by Senator Boehner, was referred to Committee Number 9, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Anderson, Coe, and Von Flatern. No, Senator Rothfuss. Excused, Senator Perkins. Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Mr. Vice President?
I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable consideration of Senate File 101. And to explain this bill, I ask that you call on the good senator from the Douglas area.
Senator Boner.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You have before you, fellow senators, Senate File 101. This deals with Title IX, and it creates a legislative finding regarding the implementation of the National Historic Preservation Act, especially onto private property. So it should be no surprise to anybody here that the federal involvement, and especially in our significant industries, can add or and does add as additional regulatory burden that many other states do not have to deal with. For example, a concrete example would be the backlog of applications for permits to drill, and particularly in the Casper Bureau of Land Management office, is the largest in the country, or at least as a few months ago was the largest in the country. And so when you have the potential of waiting up to 2 years for a permit to be approved, that imposes a significant burden on industry. That law can be applied in an inconsistent manner at the local office level. That's frustrating for both landowners, people who actually own the property, and the energy industry. Anybody knows anything about energy development? When you have the developers and the landowners on the same page, you know something is significant. So the way, and we're focusing on the National Historic Preservation Act because the interpretation and reinterpretation of that particular act has grown and has consistently expanded over the decades. And so what we're focusing on here with this little two-sentence piece of legislation is the circumstances where they're applying viewshed or similar requirements, and there's some technical terms in the bill, but we're basically dealing with viewshed being imposed onto private property or with cultural resources or potential cultural resources on private property. They're assessing the viewshed from those areas. So it has the effect of, instead of just focusing on preserving the artifact itself, they're focusing on miles and miles away, areas miles away from the actual artifact, which has the effect of massively expanding the reach of the federal government in places, frankly, on the east side of the state where the vast majority, 80 to 90% of the land is owned by private property owners. So that's what we're focusing on here. It's not about destroying our history. It's not about destroying artifacts. This is about viewshed on private property. It doesn't deal with public property. And in particular, when you have those instances, you have the ability, the landowner has the ability to deny access. And the way that stands right now is that brings the whole APD process in particular to a complete grinding halt, giving the landowner effectively a veto power over any potential permit. That's very sticky when you get into a split estate situation. Legally, I'm not an attorney, but that is a situation that needs improving, I think. So this is continuing to highlight that issue, highlight that we need reform, that we need change when it comes to this guidance. And I have to say that when you bring these issues to attention of federal leadership, the mid to higher level management within the state of Wyoming, they're very good about working with everybody involved to produce a good solution. But at the end of the day, we need some guidance from Washington, D.C. in order to bring that change about. That's what this is about, continuing to have that discussion, continuing to have that dialogue, and recognizing that this is not a short-term issue. We're putting these as a legislative finding in statutes because we recognize that a one-time resolution isn't going to cover us over the length of time it's probably going to take to have serious reform. For example, we have I have a memo from the Office of the Solicitor with Department of Interior from 1999, which seemed to have changed interior policy significantly. So when these situations where the landowner denies access, instead of denying the permit, they just sit on it indefinitely, effectively, keeping making the legal challenge much more difficult. And so I think that highlights the questionable legal nature of current policies that have been around for decades now, have spanned multiple administrations. And, and also it's important to point out that, it's not necessarily always a massive
intentional shift in federal policy. It could be a local employee, a mid to low-level employee within the federal government that just kind of decides that they're going to do their own thing. And that's why these seemingly superficial measures that were taken like this, like a legislative finding, can have a positive effect. And they have had a positive effect over the past several months. We've highlighted this issue with some of our select committees that has produced serious results. I imagine this will keep up that momentum as we move into the next interim. So that's the idea behind the bill. That's what it does. Remember, we're just recognizing in those very specific situations where we're talking about view shed or similar requirements onto private property, and the way that the federal government deals with that to ensure that that does not gum up the process. That's what we're discussing here. I understand that, and I will be bringing a second reading amendment to clean up the language and make it simpler to understand, maybe a little less technical. But we'll be doing that to make sure that we effectively communicate, because I think there is some confusion about this bill. But that's the idea of the bill, and I hope I can earn your support, certainly answering questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You know, this bill is a little bit difficult for me. You know, it's... The bill really stands as a simple statement of dissatisfaction. It really doesn't provide any direction or requirement or enforcement action or anything. It's basically a complaint against the federal government, and I don't believe it really belongs in state law. You know, it clutters our statutes with wording that I think is better suited for a resolution than a bill, a statute. The National Historic Preservation Act protects parts of Wyoming which are our most proud heritage, you know, our culture, our legacy, our landscape, and many ranchers have relied on these provisions to maintain their properties the way they want them. In most cases, the law has been applied in Wyoming in a pretty thoughtful manner, respective of landowners' rights. The Act encourages cooperation among all parties involved. I am speaking on behalf of an organization that I belong to, of architects that believe the NHPA is very, very important. The Act really encourages cooperation among parties involved. Wyoming already works with federal agencies to make the permitting process under the NHPA as efficient as possible. And a resolution or other communication asking the federal government to set timelines for this process makes sense. I'm not so sure that this legislation makes sense because of the lack of direction. And because Senate File 101, in my opinion, lacks teeth, if passed, it has the potential to create more conflict between landowners and the federal government. In the end, this may only cause further delays as federal agencies are required to follow the provisions of the law as written. So, again, I question the need for it. I think it belongs more in a resolution than it does in statute. Thank you, Mr. President, or Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I share some of the concerns that we just heard from the good senator from here in Laramie County. And wanted to take it a little bit further because when we talked about this in committee, there was some good testimony and some good discussion about specific examples where the National Historic Preservation Act was used in some awkward circumstances that ended up delaying an activity that should have been a perfectly reasonable activity. So these were rational concerns that were brought forward in committee. The concern I have, Mr. Chairman, is the language that we see here, and I appreciate the fact that the good senator that sponsors this is going to try and bring some clarifying language, because the language we have here is a broad generalization. It basically says that this National Historic Preservation Act is always bad. It always hinders things. And I don't know that we necessarily as a legislature agree upon that. I think there are a lot of good things that this act does. But that's what the first sentence does. It says specifically, this is always bad. The second sentence says that those negative consequences could be remedied if federal agencies refrain from imposing any delay or restriction on any federal funding, approval, or permit based on any indirect effect, setting requirement, viewshed requirement, or similar requirements on private property within a project's area of potential effect. So in other words, we don't care as long as no agency ever does anything about it. Then that's fine. And again, that's a lot broader than the concerns that are trying to be addressed. So I do look forward to different language here. If what we want to say, Mr. Chairman, is that the state of Wyoming doesn't appreciate it when this act is used to slow down legitimate activities on private property, then that's the language that should be used. Much, much narrower, something that the legislature can get behind. The second point I'd like to make, Mr. Chairman, is to agree with my good colleague from here in Laramie County about the fact that I realize that in a recent year we put findings about federal agency actions into the statutes. I'm pretty confident I didn't vote for it the first time. I'm not excited about voting for it this time. We have non-codified law, or we have resolutions as places where we typically put legislative findings so that our statutes don't end up just expanding to the point where they're intractable. And I think it would be more appropriate once we redraft this to the point where it's narrow and focused if we put it into the non-codified section of law as we've done in the past with most of the findings that the legislative body supports. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion? Senator Case.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I echo the sentiments of the previous two speakers. I think it's just bad policy just to strike out at a federal law. Just like this. Imagine if this was the Environmental Protection Act or something. We hate the Environmental Protection Act, and whatever the next sentence would say, we don't like you enforcing this. We wouldn't do that. This does the same thing because it just attacks the whole law. And frankly, the second sentence doesn't really help me on this because it lists. We heard the discussion about viewshed. I appreciate that. But there's more in that sentence than viewshed. Approval or permit based on any indirect effect. I don't know what that is. Setting requirement. I don't know what that is. I do understand the word viewshed, sort of. Or similar requirements. I don't know what that means. But it comes after a first sentence that says, we don't like this and stay out of our business. Don't apply it to Wyoming. So, Mr. President, I think the other factor here is there's a lot of people in Wyoming that have historic ranch properties. They're proud of their properties. They're trying to preserve those properties. Those are landowners that are affected by this law, too. They have used this law to protect their family's heritage, property rights, historic use of the land. That's a good thing. We frequently go to a picnic sponsored by the largest organization that represents stock growers. We're proud of those wonderfully preserved ranches. We love them. We love the fact that easements can be put on those ranches to preserve them. Those people benefit from the act. So if we're not going to use the act in that instance, I mean, if we're not going to use it in the people that want to get rid of it, we got to be fair, both sides of the coin. If it's not going to apply like the first sentence says, then we're going to have a lot of very unhappy landowners.
Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I echo the sentiments of the previous speakers, and I just thought this would probably be a better resolution because if we put a complaint about the federal government in our statutes, we're going to have to kill a lot more trees.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, trees are a renewable resource and it creates economy and diversifies our economy. So I think that was an absolute excellent suggestion. So, Mr. Chairman, I would like to first on and for the bill, and I'm going to tell you why. And first I'm going to try to dispel some of the discussion that's gone in. There's a fundamental difference between a historic ranch designated by our state's Historic Preservation Office, which is a state entity. It's not the federal government that does that. So let's segregate that issue out there. What we're talking about in line one is actually the implementation of the act. The first part of this is spot on. It has now become the National Historic Preservation Act, Section 106, has become the tool of choice by some of the federal agencies to hinder, stop, and impede any economic activity on the landscape, including private property on numerous occasions. So how do they do that? And this is the implementation part of the act. You have levels of archaeological surveys that are required. And the lowest level is a level one study. It is a search of the database that resides with the state of Wyoming. And if nothing's on that and you do your level one study, you're cleared to go. The most complicated way to do this is through a level three, which means you have to have a paid archaeologist go out and walk a transect on every piece of ground. Supposedly, it was originally intended for surface disturbing activity. So if you were going to disturb an artifact or some historical or cultural, this thing has been expanded to include that you can't spray herbicides, you can't go masticate vegetation for sage-grouse habitat without having an archaeologist walk every single piece. You can't participate in programs unless they come onto your farmstead and go through your dump, because some of that machinery out there is over 50 years old, so it's an eligible property. So the point that I think the resolution tries to get to, it's not the act that we have a problem with here. It's the way certain federal agencies, and it's not across the board, it varies from office to office, agency to agency. There's no inconsistency. We can go out with the Farm Bill program, masticate juniper trees with a level one for sage-grouse habitat. You step this far, and all of a sudden you're on BLM ground. It takes a year to get an archaeologist out there to run his transect, and guess what? It's a non-surface disturbing activity. It's not the act that we're after. It's how it's being implemented. This is what this addresses. I wouldn't argue that there's not some language that could be tightened up on the second paragraph. The sponsor said he's willing to do that in the second reading amendment. Let's move this down the road, but there is a major problem with how it's being implemented, inconsistency across the board.
Further discussion, Senator Case.
Mr. President, Mr. Chairman, I think we need to clear up one thing, though. State registration of these historic places, that's comes underneath the national this very act. That's how it becomes a national historic place. So state, I think it's called the SHPO office. They actually use that registry, Mr. Chairman, because of the National Historic Preservation Act. So it's one leads to the other. So you can't have half unless we're going to set up our whole thing, but it wouldn't have the national significance of these other designations, so it wouldn't protect you in the same manner. That needs to be cleared up, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I've got considerable split estate land, so I have a question for the sponsor here. To use this tool you've described to make people who want to do things on that split estate land without paying adequate surface damages, to use this tool, do you have to be registered as a historic ranch or some kind of a historic place, or can you use this tool without having to do that?
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along those lines, because I think the comment made by the tall senator from Natrona County is a good one. A point that I raised is you don't have to be a willing or voluntary landowner for this proclamation to apply. So if you want protection under this act and you believe in the integrity of this surface feature, but somebody else owns the mineral estate, what we're saying is, it's private property. We don't want to hear from you feds. We don't want anything delaying the action. We still want to be able to roll in there onto the private property, regardless of what the historic significance of it is, and be able to produce those minerals, which again, I don't think is consistent with the intent of the language and might be something that we could address in Second Amendment.
Senator Rothfuss. Senator Boner.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I guess to address that most recent discussion, whether there's a federal action triggered or not, just based off of my media family's experience in Converse County and split estate situations and our neighbors, our statutes are adequate to give the landowner a seat at the table. So whether there's a federal government involved or not, there are adequate provisions in place to give landowners leverage to the point where they have to enter into good faith negotiations with that landowner. They can't just condemn their way on. And the way the case law is played out with that particular statute has been relatively favorable to the landowners, the owner of the surface estate in that particular case. So this idea that, you know, the oil and gas company is just going to roll on and do whatever they want is simply not accurate, even when the federal government is not involved. Now, that being said, once you do insert that additional federal nexus, sure, in theory, that could go both ways. It could be used to your advantage as a landowner. It could be used to the advantage of the oil and gas operator. But that doesn't substantially change from when the federal government is not involved in these situations. Like I said, I will be reworking the language, the precise language, to include probably, acknowledging that there are positive effects of the NHPA as well. So I appreciate that feedback, but we'll make sure we qualify that first sentence with that. But we also have to recognize that regulatory burden is real. It's quite serious. It's not going anywhere, regardless of what administration is in charge or who's on the ground making it work. So I think that it is appropriate to acknowledge that burden that states, frankly, to the east of us just do not have to deal with, and make sure that the federal government keeps that in mind when it makes policy. And as we said, just to clarify, since the discussion got off track a little bit, we're not talking about destroying historic properties. We're talking about viewshed on private property, and obviously we're talking about a delay in permitting due to the objections of the landowner. So let's keep those three circumstances in mind when we're discussing this bill. That's what we're talking about. It's not talking about weakening the NHPA to the point where if the landowner does want to have their assets preserved, that we're taking that step. So.
Further discussion. Senator Scott.
Chairman, as I understand the discussion, he is trying to destroy a tool that a landowner can use to get more reasonable behavior out of some mineral outfit coming on. Mr. Chairman, I think I'm going to declare a conflict of interest in this bill.
Further discussion? Seeing none, you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Von Fladern's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 101, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no?
No.
Chairs in doubt. All those in favor, please rise. Hang on. All those opposed? Seven. 20-7, it passes. Senate File 101 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 107. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 107, Lawful Fence Standards Preemption, an Act Relating to Fences and Cattle Guards, sponsored by Senator Hicks, was referred to Committee Number 5, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Barnard, Emmerich, Hicks, Meyer, and Moniz. Senator Hicks, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Hicks?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could find my bill, I would move it. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move Senate file, or when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, it do, I, Let me start over. I don't know what I want to do, Mr. Chairman, but I want to do something. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report that it do so with a recommendation that Senate File 107 do pass. Ladies and gentlemen, this is just a good little bill here that cleans up confusion as far as jurisdiction. Mr. Chairman, there is a Standing Committee Amendment. Could I have that read in?
Senate File 107, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1 after line 13.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to work the bill, and then I'll bring in the Standing Committee Amendment. This just goes to one provision in our fencing standards within the state of Wyoming. You can see the whole bill is on the first page in subsection A. It just says, no county shall adopt an ordinance, bylaw, or other regulations relating to a lawful fence which varies from the standards set forth in 1128-102. Mr. Chairman, that's the bill. I'm going to bring in the Standing Committee Amendment now. It adds a new subsection B.
Senator Hicks, could you move the amendment, please?
Has it been read in?
It's been read in. It hasn't been moved.
Okay. I'll move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 107. Ask for your favor. Let me explain the amendment, Mr. Chairman. This brings in a new subsection B. One of the issues that arose is that predicated the need for this legislation is we have a county that is actually implementing planning and zoning regulations that would require landowners at their expense to go modify fences based on designation of certain zones within the county. What subsection B brings in and says no county shall require any landowner to modify a fence that already meets or exceeds the requirements of 1128, which is our lawful fence standards. Mr. Chairman, I would ask for adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment.
We're on the amendment. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Hicks's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 107, please say aye. Those opposed, Standing Committee Amendment 101 to Senate File 107 has passed. We're back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I had a hard time with that, too. With that, Mr. Chairman, if there's no questions, I'd call for the question on the bill.
Any discussion on the bill? Senator Case?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. So how would this affect a county that has adopted zoning? So does it just preempt their zoning? They can't have zoning. How would it affect things like small acreages or how would it affect highway right-of-way fences? You know, this is kind of a big deal. Wildlife migration, and it's gotten sort of more important, Mr. Chairman. We've decided to realize the value of it. And in fact, like the Wyoming Department of Transportation, we're spending millions and millions and millions for wildlife-friendly crossings and refencing that area. So how does this affect all that? How does this interact? And if a county has adopted zoning, does this preempt that? I assume that's the intent, but can we talk about that a little bit more?
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, it doesn't have any effect on YDOT. They're a state agency, and this only deals with county ordinances, bylaws, or other regulatory aspects that the county would promulgate. As far as the planning and zoning, it has nothing to do with that other than the fence standards. And all it does is says that the counties have to comply with the fence standards established by the state of Wyoming. Doesn't tell them there's a whole list of type of fences that are available, which include wildlife-friendly fences in our fence standing. Could be buck and rail. There's a provision that you have to put a top rail on there. Doesn't preclude the counties from adopting those, but it also preempts the county and says you can't compel somebody to have to go modify their fence. That's what provision B does, says you can't go tell a landowner just because somebody has decided that there's an other purpose that needs to be addressed here that at your expense you go modify that fence. Just the average cost of a construction of a mile of a three-wire barbed wire fence nowadays is in excess of over $10,000, and that's on really flat ground. You start getting into some of this more difficult terrain, you can literally run into $15,000 to $20,000 a mile. for a standard three-wire barbed fence, which is a lawful fence under the state of Wyoming. So I hope that addresses the good senator from Fremont County's questions.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just not sure that it does. Supposing it's a new fence, new insulation, can a county regulate what type of fence that is if they've adopted cumulative zoning? Not, it's not grandfathering an old fence, but it's a new fence. I'd like to know the answer to that question.
Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question for the bringer of the bill. I'm just curious to know how widespread this problem is. You mentioned one county, and I'm just thinking through if the county commissioners in that particular county are acting unreasonably, don't those people affected have recourse when they look at their county commissioners' races that are coming up? I'm just curious about how, why the state, if this is a widespread problem where the state needs to intervene.
Further discussion, Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, to add a little, I think a little meat on some of the examples, when we see a requirement that says wildlife-friendly fence, it takes the sheep business largely out of business. When you have a top rail and smooth wire up so far off the ground on the bottom wire, those fences are designed for animals to go through, go under, go over. And if you're in the livestock business, either keeping livestock in or keeping them out of a place, those fences aren't great for that. And you've got to be able to, for example, with sheep, quite often it's net wire. Over in our side of the mountain, one of the guys running sheep up there, he tries to do it as natural as he can. He moves his feed grounds from hill and swale around the place so that he's feeding in different spots. They can work the ground in, go with the natural fertilizer. But that also requires being able to move your fences. Under some of this proposed regulation, it would stop that. You can only build a wildlife-friendly fence. Now there's talk about, well, there's still an ag exemption, but that ag exemption, as it's been described, is for 70-acre parcels and larger. And if you'll recall, last year we took on a bill about ag valuation, and that had to do with combined pieces of property, including headquarters spots. The proposed or the zoning that's out there right now and is much more restrictive, and in fact actually makes it so a person could have a 70-acre, 100-acre piece of land, and right next to it, a 40-acre piece adjoining property, and would have to build this incredibly expensive and not very effective fence on that 40 acres. It makes it very difficult for people who are still trying to make their living in ag, and we still have some people who do that. As for being able to take that to the voters, they're in a minority. And is ag important in our state? And I'd suggest as our number three economy, it is important. It's important in a lot of ways, whether you like the viewscape, whether you like that we're still producing food, you know, whether you like our heritage. I think ag is very important to Wyoming, and I have great concerns. And I'll just share with you, this isn't the first time I spoke. I have visited with the local electeds of that community and explained to them the issues we were facing and why it was important. And at this point, I think a remedy like this, while it may feel extreme without understanding the circumstances, it's the kind of a thing that can take agriculture out of a whole county.
Further discussion? Seeing none. You ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Hicks's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 107, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Senate File 107 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 113. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 113, Community Development Districts, an Act Relating to Cities and Towns, sponsored by Senator Nethercott, was referred to Committee Number 7, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Agar, Nethercott, Pappas, and Scott. No, Senator Case. Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move
to report that it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 113, Community Development Districts. There is a standing committee amendment. Mr. Chairman, I ask it be read in.
Senate File 113, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 8, line 16.
And Mr. Chairman, I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 113, and I would ask that you yield to Senator Nethercott.
Senator Nethercott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senators, you have before you Senate File 113, Community Development Districts. The genesis of this bill came from a lack of, or of a need from developers in the state of Wyoming to have different avenues for revenue generation, particularly when doing large developments. Particularly here in Laramie County, we have a couple of developments that are of a larger scale. And when they went to start working with the county where these large swaths of land are located for these developments, it was determined that the infrastructure that was available provided by the county just wasn't enough. And so decisions were made for these properties to be annexed in. And there's a number of them here in Laramie County currently in that process. And so then pursuant to the annexation process, it was determined again by the municipalities after annexation took place that the municipalities really weren't in a position financially to take on the scope of these developments either. You know, they plan their budgets just like we do, looking into the future, recognizing you do plan for growth, but maybe not in the scope that some of these developers hope to see that growth take place. And so this bill is a result of meeting that need and providing a necessary tool to our communities and our developers so that growth can continue to happen in the state of Wyoming. So the bill is called Community Development Districts, and as we turn to page 2, as I go through the bill, you can see that I hope it to become the Community Development District Act. Pages 2 through 5 deal with the definitions as found in the bill, but for purposes of time and explanation, I'll kind of get to the meat of the bill, and we can refer back to the definitions as necessary. So when we go to page 5, section 103, it identifies what the district's authorized to do, its general function, and as you can see there in subparagraph A, lines 16 through 18 on page 5, it's any area exclusively within the boundaries of a municipality, and it may be formed to do the following functions: acquire, construct, operate, and maintain improvements of local necessity and convenience, obtain improvements and services by contracting for the same with any city, town, county, or other entity, furnish or perform any special local service that enhances the use or enjoyment of any improvement or facility. And then I'm on page 6 now, lines 9 through 18. This is a really important provision, subparagraph B, which really goes to the constitutionality of this particular act and this particular district, that the district shall not be formed to provide improvements and services defined by the municipality as basic and customarily available. So whatever the district is intending to do, it must be different than what the municipality provides. Additionally, if the municipality becomes to be in a position where it can provide those services, the district has two options at that point, which is to dissolve or to change its general plan. And I'll get to the general plan here later in the bill in a couple of pages, and I'll do this quickly. Moving on down the bill on page 7, the creation of the district. The creation of the district has to be done by a petition by 25% of the landowners of the district. They present their petition to the governing body of the municipality, so the city council and the mayor, in your typical municipality across the state. In addition, as part of this petition is supposed to be a general plan, and that general plan is really important to understanding of how this district can work. Mr. Chairman, there is actually the standing committee amendment found on page 8, which is where we are reading through the bill on lines. On line 16 should be added. So when the governing body of the municipality receives a petition for the formation of the district by 25% of the landowners, which includes a general plan, and the municipality moves forward with that request and approves the idea of the general plan, it should be put out for a special election. The particular amendment that's proposed here is at the expense of the district. So the cost of putting this petition forward and having this election by the voters of the district has to go to election. So, Mr. Chairman, at this time, I would ask for – I'll wait, actually, to do a vote on the amendment. So we'll get there. So there is a vote of the people of the district for whether or not the district should be performed. The governing body gets to approve whether or not a district is formed, and they get to approve the general plan. The general plan is found on pages 9 through 12. That outlines with very specific detail what the district is authorized to do and the level of specification that the district is required to provide to the city. Most notably, if we look on page 10, subparagraph Roman numeral 5, as it relates to assessments, because this is the purpose of the district is to allow it the ability to create revenue in order to build the necessary infrastructure for the district, is that a statement that assessments will exist only for the period of time required to complete the improvements and complete the duties and responsibilities of the district. So there is a time period component with this. So if that particular mission is completed, then we refer back to the previous section of the bill where the purpose of the district either needs to be dissolved or its general plan needs to be amended. Moving through the bill on pages 12 through 13, we can see the powers of the district there. This particular language is mirrored from Title 18. In the counties, you can have special districts, but in a municipality, you cannot, and this allows for this particular tool within a municipality. And that language is simply mirrored from our current language. Going to page 15, lines 13 through 15, I will be proposing an amendment here in just a minute regarding the ability of the district to contract for telecommunications. I've been working with the telecommunications industry to provide some language that is satisfactory to them to meet their concerns regarding this bill. So at this time, Mr. Chairman, if I can have amendment number 1 to Senate File 113,
Standing committee amendment?
It's not a standing committee.
I don't have another amendment.
It was just handed out, Mr. Chairman.
Let's handle the standing committee amendment and then committee of the whole. I don't have the committee of the whole yet.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. So we'll continue to move through the bill and come back to that particular issue. Moving on to page 17, the intent to provide a special assessment and the notice of the declaration for the hearing on pages 18 through 19. The specification of the need to provide notice to the potential landowners of the assessment, it's very clear. As a political subdivision, this particular district is subject to the Wyoming Administrative Procedures Act, the Public Meetings Act, and so there's extensive transparency associated with this district, and of course, the municipality also gets to have one non-voting member as a board of the district, as a member of the board of the district. If an assessment is collected and that passes, the municipality is able to receive 1% of the collections to justify the costs associated with their assistance in collecting that particular levy. So at this time, Mr. Chairman, I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. I think it's already been moved, but I'd ask for any questions on that particular amendment and call for the question.
We're on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 113. Are there any questions? Hearing none. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 13, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 13 has passed. We're back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, if I may have Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 113, Committee of the Whole Amendment, Number 1 to Senate File 113, read into the record.
Senate File 113, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 4, line 5.
Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move that amendment right now. Senators, as mentioned previously, this has to deal with addressing the concerns of the telecommunications industry, and this particular amendment was crafted out of those joint efforts, and I'd ask for your favorable consideration of this amendment.
We're on Standing Committee. We're on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 113. Any discussion? Senator Rothfuss?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I urge the body to reject this amendment. And this is a carve-out of what a district is capable of. And there's a lot of work that has to go into the districts coming to existence. Broadband districts are actually a way of potentially developing broadband in communities that don't have
access at a level that they're honestly comfortable with. So there might be an interest in a county, a portion of a community, a portion of a municipality to dramatically increase the bandwidth that's available to a level that, quite frankly, private industry is not comfortable with at this time. One of the strengths, in my opinion, of this piece of legislation is the flexibility that it provides with regard to infrastructure in allowing communities to raise funds where they see necessary applications that are in the community's interest. Again, it requires formation of the district, a vote, passage of an additional mill levy, and then my expectation would be entering into some type of public-private partnership with that so that it would not have to be fully funded by the district. But again, coming in and carving out for the sake of one industry that this can't be used in a way that influences that industry seems unnecessarily limiting and not something that we do really with any of our special districts where we say, well, you can use a special district in this way to develop the community, except for in circumstances where one of the particular industries that might be affected would be offended. I think the legislation is much stronger without this amendment. It provides a tool for developing broadband for our communities in ways that are at the discretion of the voters of the community and the property holders, and I would urge the body to resist this amendment.
We're on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 13. Any further discussion? Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm not a fan of this bill, and I'd like to get into that. But it kind of relates to the amendment that's on the table. This is about a carve-out of a new area that comes into town that would be part of a franchise territory of a utility. You know, and they have the ability to serve that area. This amendment puts some kind of ability for, you know, there to be some sideboards on whether this entity can just go into the telephone business or not, Mr. Chairman. So, I mean, I know that's going to be a debate we're going to have on the broadband bill as well, but, Mr. Chairman, it is appropriate, I think, to have some restrictions. You wouldn't have a carve-out within a municipality that provided electricity service, would you? Would you have a carve-out that provided its own within a municipality that provided its own other utilities? I think that would be kind of unusual, Mr. Chairman. The current law... Well, this is an addition. I got to go back to the page before. It's very broad. It says, at least the bill, Mr. Chairman, just give me one second. I'm trying to find the telecom piece in the bill. I know it says page 5, line 7. Oh, here it is. It is page 5, line 6 and 7. It says contracting for enhanced telecommunication services. So you'd have an entire area of town that could contract for these services. What this does is say they can only do that if it's not already served. And that seems fair in the sense that, you know, these telecommunications utilities in our communities pay a franchise fee. They would have the ability to provide service in that area, wouldn't they? After all, they're being assessed a franchise fee within the entire boundary of the municipality on that. And that fee is pretty hefty, especially hefty in Wyoming. And is this fair? Are you going to exclude them from the fee? And if you want to exclude them from the franchise fee that the municipality pays, why is that fair to do it for part of the municipality and not part of the other? It's very tangled and confusing. And so I think it's a better deal. We don't have other utilities in here. Be a better deal to treat telecommunications the same. So I do support this amendment. I have comments on the bill later.
Further discussion on the amendment. Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand the concept of the unserved, and we had a discussion about this on another piece of broadband-related legislation. Unserved by the FCC standard currently, which can evolve, my understanding is that it's 10 megabit down, 1 megabit up. That's a pretty small amount of service. So you can be served at a bandwidth that, quite frankly, is not good enough for any economic development or to draw in any industry to your community. And since you're served, based on this amendment, you would not be able to do anything with this district. The concept that a district like this would be potentially valuable for is if you wanted to put fiber in to every household in a certain area, as an example, so that you would have the possibility of gigabit. You probably still wouldn't light that up as the community. It would be totally unreasonable to say that this district would then go into the business in the state of Wyoming of actually providing broadband service. I can't even fathom a community that would then do that. But the concept of putting fiber into households and to businesses downtown so that you have gigabit or better service, which would then be a prime mover for economic diversification and investment, can't be done with this. Well, what a great tool for all of our communities as we're trying to particularly encourage downtown business growth. If you could get fiber downtown and have an economic tool to provide the infrastructure for that so that you can then go to the private sector and say, hey, we have fiber, or even we have conduit, which this does allow. So the conduit is not the problem, but it's the fiber itself if there's not a business that's interested in it. We have fiber to all of our businesses downtown. Would you like to enter into an agreement and light this fiber up so that we can get gigabit to all the businesses? I can't think of a better economic development opportunity for my hometown. As a matter of fact, that's probably the A game I can think of in terms of drawing the type of industry we want to diversify to downtown Laramie, is to say, hey, we've got gigabit fiber. But we have no mechanism in statute or anywhere else to make that happen, and we certainly can't get industry to do that for us, because there is no business model that we can come up with that makes it in the interest of the private sector to run gigabit to all of the businesses downtown and the community at this point in time. They have better markets to do it. Their capital is not going to Laramie, Wyoming. It's going to other communities around the country where they'll make more money. However, the folks that are in the community, Mr. Chairman, would probably be happy to take that leap and to do what it takes to put into place the infrastructure so that it is in the private sector's interest to come in. This amendment is too restrictive. It precludes that type of behavior, and I'd urge the body to resist that amendment. I think there probably is a viable amendment that would accomplish both objectives, where we protect the interests of the private sector and the franchise concerns that we heard from the good senator from the center of the state, while allowing the municipalities and the communities to accomplish their own objectives for economic diversification.
Senator Meyer, on the amendment.
I don't know whether this bill or amendment is really going to help that much in the regards to broadband. I think it probably lies outside this bill, and that's probably to get rid of the franchise fee so you can actually have free enterprise within that area. And then you could actually, you know, get some industrial revenue bonds and form a company and be a private person and supply gigabit.
Further discussion on the amendment. Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, the basic premise is this. If it makes money for a private industry, they'll do it.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, they won't. If it's not an economical proposition, why would we allow government to do it in a way that uses mill levies assessed on property tax to do this? And this goes to some other problems I have with this bill, Mr. Chairman, but why would we do that? Why would we take property tax? This is a bill about levying property taxes in addition to the 8 mills that a municipality already can. It broadens the use of those levies, what they can be used for, and it does it in a manner that actually lets them do the same services as the municipality provides, but it's not quite satisfactory. And it also does it in an evolutionary way. Once it completes its first project, it can move on to other projects. You really got to pay attention to this bill. But having property tax be collected to run a telecommunications system, I think, is problematic. We have another statute that says that municipalities can't bond for broadband services. And so why did we put that in several years ago? If it made money for the private sector, they would do it. Why are we going to hide everything behind a property tax assessment? And that's not the purpose of the bill. The sponsor brought the bill and brought you this committee the whole amendment. I guess we ought to let her talk on this.
Further discussion on the amendment. Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, a point of privilege?
Now?
Now.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't know how long this was going to go, so I thought I'd introduce some really good public servants that have come over from the eastern side of the state here, western side of the state, excuse me, Jackson. Whoa, Jackson, if they please stand up. It's Haley Morton, who's our vice mayor, Bob Lenz, one of the maybe the senior serving members in the county or the town councils across Wyoming. Wouldn't be surprised if Bob, he's been there doing great service for a long time. Roxanne Robinson, who keeps the books. She keeps everything working in that city, and it is challenging. She's really kind of running the show. And then Larry Pardee, who is the new town manager, replacing an old legend. And Larry's got big shoes to fill, but he's been a transportation wizard. If you have any questions on municipal transportation and care, that guy can help you out. So, ladies and gentlemen, coming over from the town of Jackson.
Welcome to the Senate. Any further discussion on the amendment? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Nethercott's motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 113, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 113 has passed. We're back on the bill. Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. just President. A question of the sponsor. You set up this district, and our Constitution limits 8 mills to the cities, towns, and, of course, 12 mills to the counties. Is that part of those mills? Because there's so much competition. I see you shaking your head, but you should answer so we could all hear it, if you would, please.
Senator Nethercott.
Mr. Chairman, great question, and very important to our municipalities within the state. It does not interfere with the municipality's ability to collect their 8 mills. It is above and on top of that 8 mills. The district is its own political subdivision, as identified in the bill, and it is not authorized to provide the same services of the municipality, which is really what's important about that provision found on page 6, lines 9 through 18, which really ensures that the district cannot be formed to do those same services, ensuring that those particular issues don't cross.
Further discussion? Senator, Your Excellency.
I forgot what I was going to say, Mr. Chairman. Good. No, one step further then. You know, when we do these different districts within the city or the county, some of them have to be included in the 8 or 12 mills, some don't. So this is excluded because they're their own political subdivision? And how is that different than like a hospital district or a fire district?
Senator Nethercott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The fact its own political subdivision is a part of that analysis, but the dispositive fact is it is not providing the same services as the municipality. And so there's language throughout the bill that ensures that that does not happen, so it does not interfere with that 8 mills. Again, as identified on page 6, lines 9 through 18, and throughout. So what's really important, too, is the duration of the district. So the language of the bill specifically provides, again, throughout, that if the municipality is able to provide the services that it wasn't able to provide before based on its ability to do so, then the district shall dissolve or its purpose has to change. So that's important for the body to understand. And so there's a lot of discussion based on the amendment, but the bill and the district is much, much broader than the discussion relating to the amendment. So frequently, municipalities are challenged with particular growth regarding snow removal, for example. So if a particular district wanted to be able to provide snow removal for the first year of its operation, but then thereafter the city was in a better position to provide that service, then the district's purpose, if that was its sole purpose, and I would be hard-pressed to believe that would happen for all of the hoops one would have to go through to create a district, but if that were to happen, the district would have to dissolve or it would have to change the purpose of its assessment, and that has to be done through the process associated in the bill,
where you have to receive more than a 50% of the vote of those members of the district. So I think that that's important to understand that there are a number of protections in place to ensure that those purposes of the municipality do not interfere with that of the district, or the district's purpose don't interfere with that of the municipality.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The only thing I would ask, when you said provide the same services as a municipality would, you said that, but a hospital doesn't provide the same services as a municipality, in my estimation anyway. So is that word or their definition on service? I mean, I just want to be sure that we're not interfering with that 8 mils.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Nethercutt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The concern comes from a case, a Wyoming Supreme Court case from 1950, actually relating to a hospital district, where the court went into the analysis of whether or not it did or didn't. And that's why our statutory provisions, particularly within a municipality, allow for cemetery districts and hospital districts. It's been determined that they do not offer the same services as a municipality, but other types of issues can. This is an enhancement above and beyond those services, and the court has said that that's proper and doesn't erode into that 8 mils. So I'm happy to provide that particular opinion from the Wyoming Supreme Court, but that's the origin of those concerns. And this bill was drafted with that case in mind, ensuring that it did not erode to those 8 mils. This bill is meant to be to augment the ability of cities to develop and grow and not interfere with their current operations. That was a primary concern of the drafter of the bill.
Further discussion? Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I did some work and spent some time on the Special District Task Force along with some of the other senators. And in looking into it and discussing with our staff, got a little viewpoint from one of our attorneys who's had a lot of experience in this, that levies for required municipal functions count against the city's 8 mil limit. The parameters defining a required or necessary municipal function are not completely bright line. In the words of the court, as the good senator referred to, the 8 mils were intended to suffice for the payment of expenses incurred in performing the governmental functions essential to the convenience, safety, and happiness of the citizens of the municipality. Later in the opinion, the court stated it was a governmental function which a city or town may not avoid. So in that case, fire protection was found to be such a function. Cemeteries and the provision of hospitals were not. This bill is intended to find the categories that are not and to focus on those categories as I understand it. And I think it's adding to the tools that are available to a municipality when they don't have the resources available with the 8 mils to kind of extend out of those traditional requirements. I think it's a good tool in a budget-constrained state right now to give more flexibility to municipalities, and I believe that the body should support this bill and move forward.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was a no vote in committee, and I have some concerns about this bill. I also have some concerns about the circumstance by which the bill has been brought about. You know, I drive across this great city of Cheyenne, and I love this city. I drive across, and I see brand new streets to the north and lots of very significant, wonderful infrastructure has been put in, all those great developments, the east side of the airport and north of the airport and great viaducts, and I'm really proud of this city for pulling that off. This involves an annexation that actually occurred a couple weeks ago of a very, very large amount of land the city has now annexed and it's going to be developed. But it's huge. It's a giant tract of land, and it has it'll take years and years and years for that development to occur. The city of Cheyenne is understandably very excited about this bill. The developer of that property is also very excited about this bill because they like the way that it'll bring more resources to bear to provide infrastructure for that new property in a rapid way. But what I would argue with you, that's infrastructure that would normally be provided by the city and that the city of Cheyenne has successfully done over time, never all at once, throughout this great city, and we see it all the time. Mr. Chairman, the 8 mils in the Constitution mean something.
I think that's an important concept. Protects taxpayers. Now, this new property will not be capped by the 8 mills. The city will, of course, levy the 8 mills in that property, but there will be additional mills for services that if you go to page 6 and it says, Part B, a district shall not be formed to provide improvements and services defined by the municipality as basic and customary available to residents. Here's the big one. Except that a district may be formed to provide such an improvement or service if the improvement or service is not, in fact, available to residents of the proposed district at the time of the formation. City of Cheyenne came to our meeting, testified, we can't build the roads, we can't put in the water, we can't do any of this. So to me, that says that it's not available at the time of formation of the district, and the district will be able to come in. But they're providing streets, roads, water, ordinary things that come under the 8 mills anywhere else, and the ordinary things that the city of Cheyenne have successfully put out throughout this great city. This benefits the developer, it benefits Cheyenne, but it hurts those people that reside in that district because they have to pay more taxes. Now, Mr. Chairman, let's carry this a step further. It was shocking to me that they talked about snow removal in the committee meeting, that was an example of something that the district could provide is snow removal. And so I thought, really? I thought it was a municipal function to provide snow removal. Granted, my town doesn't get to my house that rapidly, but basically snow removal is a big deal. So now you have the situation where the district can acquire and provide services as the city withdraws from providing those services that we kind of thought were important. So the city of Cheyenne can provide snow removal everywhere, but we can't get to it in the district, so the district will pay for that. Well, is that fair? People in Cheyenne pay 8 mills and get that. People in the district might be paying 8 plus whatever and have to pay extra for it. Now they live in a nice place, it's new, it's brandly developed, but who benefits from that? Is this really fair? And think how this evolves over time. Think about this, that you can form a district for one purpose and you can evolve into other purposes as you go forward. Why do we have this limit in the Constitution? This is wholly within a municipality, and it really is facilitating faster development of something that will yield profits for the developer, help Cheyenne to grow faster, all these things. But is that really constitutionally what we think is right? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, not to drag it on, this is I find it really interesting. I was just arguing kind of a different point of this a day or so ago, and the difference with this and what happens in a lot of other places, this is voluntary. They file a permit, 25% of landowners, 25% of the value. They're asking to improve. It's not the city telling them to improve. It's them asking to be able to do it. You know, that's one of the real problems we have in the state of Wyoming is you get into these cities and you get around them, and we tend to develop our countryside instead of the city because all of a sudden these services aren't there in the city. They impose certain things without the ability of having something exactly like this. So they go build on a 40 in the country or out of town. And this is, to me, this is exactly what you need. When you move in and you say, we'd like a neighborhood that's better, that's nicer, and this often happens, and their hands are tied. They don't have a process. This gives them a process, and it's a process that's given with permission, and it's given by a vote. And, you know, a lot of the processes we have in towns don't come with a vote. It comes with them telling you. This is a vote. It's voluntary. The bill's good, and it's an enhancement to a city, not an extraction.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman. I share some of the same reservations that the good chairman of corporation shares, but I was in an I vote in committee. Mr. Chairman, I think this bill is going to be a creative solution to a very real need that some cities have in terms of getting expansion that is properly done, properly paid for, and makes the city a more attractive place to live because there is good quality housing available with good services. Mr. Chairman, theoretically, we'd like to stay within what the city can afford with its 8 mills, but we all know those 8 mills are totally inadequate, that we've supplemented them. Seems to me there was another bill around that had $105 million in it for cities and counties that we passed several times. We've given them a share of state sales tax. We've given them a share of state severance tax. We've done a lot of things because our cities and counties also, but this bill concerns the cities, can't afford to do the things that the population demands and expects. And this is a creative solution to a piece of that problem. It will, I think, help the city of Cheyenne quite a bit with the very real needs that the city has. I do think that we will be legislating again on this topic. I think the system evolved here may be very useful for commercial properties that need a different level of some of these services than a city can provide. But you run the risk there of having a district without any significant population. We'll have to modify this law eventually for that. I suspect that city developers and city planners will get creative in the use of these districts, and we may eventually have to curb some abuses. I think those people can be very creative, and it's difficult to anticipate what they might do. But this, you can let the perfect be the enemy of the good. This is a good bill. It will help solve a real problem here. I think will be useful for other cities in this state, Mr. Chairman, and I would urge the Senate to adopt it.
Further discussion? Seeing none. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 113, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? No. Senate File 113 is passed, Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole beg leave to rise and sit again in about 10 minutes.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor signify by saying, oh. Wait a minute. Wait. Senator Peterson.
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Privilege of the floor?
Yes.
Thank you. With us in the gallery, we don't get visitors from the north very much down here, but we have the mayor of Powell, John Wetzel, and his wife, Shelby. If you'd join me and welcome them to the Senate.
There they are.
Okay, we have a motion on the floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Those opposed, motion passes.
You know, I can tell just by your look how you like bills are